Herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Folge vom One More Level Podcast. Heute mit mir und Philipp. Nur mit mir. Nein, das stimmt auch wieder nicht ganz. Ich habe heute nämlich einen Gast, und zwar einen ganz speziellen Gast, den Jonathan Wendell, besser bekannt als der Fatality. Er ist einer der ersten, wenn nicht der erste Pro-Gamer, den es je gegeben hat. Also wirklich richtig dick drin im E-Sports, auch heute noch. Und mit dem quatsche ich ein bisschen über seine Karriere und was er heute so macht, warum er Valorant spielt und warum er möglicherweise Battle Royale vorausgesagt hat. Ja, und könnt ihr euch gerade auch noch ein bisschen lustig machen über mein tolles Englisch in dem Interview. Ja, viel Spaß.
I'm curious with the younger audience who maybe don't remember you, but you're for me, I'm 1 year younger than you. I knew you like back in the day, and it was like, yeah, you were just kind of a legend, and it was really interesting to see you again. So I'm curious what they think, the young people about.
I think in any sport or any profession, you know, people need to be educated on the history and you know, obviously, I still am pretty active in esports, doing different businesses, and I still play a lot because I really love to play. But I think it's like, you know, when I look at, like, you know, if you look at basketball, there's always that OG in basketball. You always have the OG in golf and OG and everything. So I'm still pretty young. I'm only 39, but definitely in the gaming world, like, I'm the older guard. But I think I might have more praise when I'm older. Yeah, I think when I pass maybe the 50 mark or the 60 mark, that's when people really start to jump on. I'm like, oh yeah, I remember, you know. So I'm on my way, man. I'm on my way. We're all on our way, actually.
When do you think was the cutoff? When at which age did it become more difficult to compete with other players?
Well, I never really had that problem. You know, I think what gamers go through is eventually they have responsibilities, or they have distractions that lower their skill level because they can't practice as hard or play as hard. For me, my whole career, I was always able to compete at the very highest and win. You know, when I stepped away from esports, it was more or less to help esports grow and get more mainstream coverage through, you know, when I worked for DirecTV, bringing esports to television and so forth. So for my reasoning for stepping away was kind of like, I've accomplished, you know, everything I kind of set out to do in esports. But the timing for me to move to my next transition was perfect. You know, obviously, arena shooters also kind of fell off when I quit too, and so almost all of the games changed to MOBA games or team tournaments and so forth. And I was mostly known for being, you know, the 1v1 deathmatch guy. So playing me 1v1, it was not good for their guy. I think arena shooters are, you know, There's it's a real high skill cap, and, you know, it doesn't really cater to the masses that much, just because of the skill level so high. But you look at, like, tennis is a perfect example of skill cap being way so high. Like, how's anyone supposed to ever compete with the pros? I feel like in gaming, you know, the game developers themselves build games so everyone feels like they're a superstar. And, you know, so for me, it's like, you know, it's more about team than it is about individual skill. And these days.
Yeah. But I mean, there are mostly, the pros are mostly young players around 20. So I always wonder how much really is a question of reflexes, and the other thing you said, like, people get other priorities and.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, I can give an example, like, just like 2 years ago or so, I was playing PUBG, and I decided to take out a mission to become number one on the North America leaderboards in PUBG for solos.
Yeah.
And I basically took me a month and a half, and I was able to achieve it. Nice. And I kind of did my old training regimen, you know, practice, and basically I was able to get number one spot, and I held it for like 10 days.
Nice.
So the thing is, like, at 37 at that time, you know, I was just trying to show people that, you know, you know, it's not an age thing or a reflex thing. I mean, of course, you know, these things naturally deteriorate or whatever deal is, but the amount of knowledge and experience that, you know, a person like myself has, you know, playing games for over two decades, I'm able to use that, you know, against, you know, younger kids that probably just don't know yet. They don't know what the risk they're taking when they do whatever they're doing, right? But, you know, the thing is, not to say that, you know, 18-year-old kid ain't smart. You know, I was 18 and was world champion at Quake 3, and I was making good decisions back then too. So I think it comes down to whoever gets the most reps in and who wants it the most. So I don't think there's really an age barrier really on that too much, but there is responsibilities that people have, you know, like, you know, and also the fire of wanting to compete every day and every second and every moment because it's so exciting, it's so new, it's so fresh, you know. So, you know, a young kid can, you know, he doesn't have to worry about maybe, you know, paying rent because he's living at his parents' house. He doesn't have to worry about real life stuff, you know?
Yeah.
So all that weighs on a person. And that's kind of how I got into esports. I basically would weigh out, you know, I tried to reduce all of my responsibilities down to only where I could only, my only responsibility is to be the best in the world at X game. So basically my goal was to strip everything to, you know, get, you know, if my rent, if I had rent, you know, I had to make money somehow, but luckily for me, I was making money playing video games. but I had a very simple life to help me train and help me focus on my training. So there's a lot to be said there.
But so when did you decide to, you were like 17 or something when you became a pro? I mean, it probably was a fluid.
Yeah, well, I started playing tournaments, you know, when I was, you know, younger than that. I started playing tournaments basically at the age of like 11, 12 years old. And then when Quake 1 came out, I started playing first person shooters. So 1996. And I started playing tournaments when I was 15 years old. And I won every tournament I entered for like about 3 years. Mm-hmm. And then I went to my very first like big pro tournament, I guess you could say. It's kind of hard to say what's pro and what's not pro back then, but it was the one that I felt, I think everyone agreed that all the best players were there, you know, to some extent. And that was Frag 3 in 1999. And that's kind of when I considered, I guess, when I went pro, because I won money. I won $4,000 that tournament. So all the other tournaments I won before that, I won, like, you know, prizes and giveaways and internet subscriptions and all the stars, pool crap, you know, just like, just you know, hand-me-outs kind of thing. And for me, 1999 was a $25,000 purse prize. I was playing against the best players, flying in from Sweden, flying in from Europe, all over America, and playing against the best players. And that was, I was 18 then when I played my very first pro tournament.
So what did you do about school?
So I just graduated high school, and I was going to college part-time. I found a way to make money playing video games very quickly. And so I ended up leaving school and focusing 100% on gaming, as I had sponsorship money coming in. I had prize money coming in. All my travel and food expenses were paid for. And I think I ended up making over $110,000 my first year as a professional gamer.
Oh, not bad.
So I had a good little launch pad.
But are there things you think you missed out on while you were?
I think in life.
Yeah, yeah, because you needed so much time to like train.
Yeah, I mean the thing is, like, I always wanted to do that in my life. So like I feel like, you know, from as a young kid to 18, I lived a very full life of playing sports every day, hanging out with friends, had a girlfriend, you know, for a few years. And, you know, kind of lived all that life. But the part of me, like, just deep down was like, I wanted to see if I was talented enough to play with the best players in the world. And I didn't care what it was in. I wanted to be an athlete. I wanted to play sports. I wanted to do things. And I never really felt I got, like, the chance to dedicate all my energy to one thing. I was always, like, kind of like the Renaissance guy. Like, I was good at everything, but never the best. And so I wanted to, like, kind of, like, put my head down and put all my effort, energy, training, focus, diet, running, everything was dedicated to one goal, be the best gamer in the world. And so then basically I went on to execute that. And, you know, the sacrifices were, you know, family, friends, and so forth. But I made new friends. I made new friends and people that also had the same dream and initiative that I had to be the best gamer in the world. So it was, I wouldn't trade it for, anything. It was like, I mean, it was literally the best time of my life was training, practicing, traveling the world, playing video games, winning on the biggest stage. And, you know, obviously it launched me into my career, you know, into making products for gamers and then doing other startups in esports. So, yeah, it's been an amazing ride. It's pretty surreal, actually.
Nice. And but what did your family or friends think about you becoming a pro and like playing video games all the time? Because esports was probably almost non-existent back then.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I was kind of the first, you know, one of the first guys to really break out in esports. You know, before me, there was a guy named Dennis Thresh Fong. He won a Ferrari for playing video games. So I think every gamer knew that you could win like really cool shit in gaming. And, you know, after Thresh, I kind of became the guy who really started pushing the envelope, you know, create my own hardware, my own products. And, you know, it took a while for my parents to understand it. But, you know, I was winning money and I was making good money. But the thing is, there's no security. There's no retirement plan for professional gamers. So, you know, so I had to be smart with my money. I had to be an entrepreneur and make sure I, you know, at the end of the day, add up how much money I made and how much I won and how much I save. And when I first made my first money in gaming, I just instantly started making products for gamers. I had my money that I won from gaming, and I was like, well, hell, if I made this all playing video games, I'm gonna lose it all playing video games. And so I started investing in myself, making hardware for gamers like mouse pads and so forth. And then eventually, I started partnering with major manufacturers to make Fatality products across the globe. And so I took a big bet on my own, on myself, creating a brand for gamers. And that turned out to be one of my best decisions in my life. So
was that your idea with the hardware products?
Yeah. Yeah. As a kid, I always wanted to make products for gamers just for myself, because I noticed when I played, 6 hours at a time, whatever deals I'd have, like, my wrist would get sore, or, you know, my, you have like different pain points, I guess, when you play that much time in front of a computer. And so I basically created the first large gaming mouse pad. this company made this pad, which was like a printer pad. It was used for printers. Basically, I started using it as a mouse pad, and I started winning all these tournaments. And every gamer was like, what kind of mouse pad is that? And like, you know, it's like, oh, it's a large gaming size mouse pad, like, you know, so I started branding the mouse pad because no one was making it. And so I kind of have the title of making the first large gaming mouse pad in the world. And so I started selling that off my own website, fatality.com. And then I started doing distribution calls to salespeople in Europe and Germany, and then also selling it over in Japan and China. I think it was mostly just Japan at the beginning. But people were buying my products, and you know, I was selling them by making business phone calls, like, hey, you should distribute my Fatality mouse pad. And they're like, wait, this is Fatality? And I'm like, yeah, and you're selling mouse pads. And so it was really funny, you know, what I was doing. I was only 22 years old, I think.
Like a salesman.
21 or 22 years old. And so it was really a lot of fun as a young entrepreneur to be doing this. But yeah, I mean, it was something that was very cool and very exciting at that time in my life.
Yeah, I always remember the sound cards. I think I still have a Fatality sound blaster. Are they called sound blasters? But from Creative.
Yeah. And it was, yeah. So those deals were a little bit different. Those were more like licensing deals.
Yeah.
So those companies would come to me and want to sponsor me. But I wasn't really available for sponsorships at that time in my career. So I was only doing partnerships where we make a Fatality product powered by Creative Labs or by 8-bit or by ASRock or whoever the company was. And basically we would license the brand to that company, and then I would help them design the product for gamers. So yeah, like the headphones, for example, with Creative Labs, it was very easy to do that deal because I had a lot of input. I think we were also the first gaming headset with a detachable microphone. So a lot of the things I was creating in my early days was like the first of its kind.
So it was not just the branding. It was, you were involved with the development of the product.
Yeah. So that's the meaning behind a Fatality product, is that I actually have input and so forth into the product. You know, and motherboards is a little bit less, because I'm not a motherboard designer, but I can tell them, okay, well, if this gives me better input lag or better latency to the game, like, can I overclock it more? Can I get this thing at a higher frequency and so forth? So then they start building the specs out on the motherboard to my liking. And so that's how you'd have like these kind of like special features in the Fatality product for motherboards.
How important do you think is the right equipment? Because like I just tested the 240 hertz monitor, and like the mice always get faster, the sensors and the mechanical keyboards and all this stuff. And some people swear by it. I know people who play on an old CRT. And so what do you think? How important is the equipment really?
Well, some games are designed to be like 16 by 9 versus like 4 by 3, which is CRTs typically. I still think CRTs are amazing, but they don't really exist anymore. You're getting probably 3 milliseconds of lower latency on a CRT versus a TN panel. But yeah, it's kind of hard to beat the 16 by 9 standard these days.
Sure.
And the monitors are getting pretty good. So it's just, having a thinner, lighter monitor in front of you instead of a big 19-inch CRT. I still have my CRT in my back room.
Nice.
I broke it out a couple of times to play PlayerUnknown Battlegrounds on it. And it wasn't working as you think it would, because there's no 4x3 option in PUBG. It doesn't really come across correctly through the signal.
Yeah.
The signal is just too outdated. So there's just a lot of like games that it just does not work on.
Yeah.
So that's why you have to get away from the CRTs. What was your other question?
But do you think like 240 hertz, or because regular monitors just have 60 hertz, and now the
monitors I think going from 60 to 120 is a massive deal back in the day. I mean, if you weren't playing 120 hertz, you were not playing the game really to its full potential. So equipment is definitely important. I guess we can go through the list. like a monitor, 60 hertz versus 120, 144, 240. If you have 60, you should definitely upgrade to at least 144 in today's standard. At 144, I feel like you're good. 144 to 240 is, I don't really notice a massive difference, but I'm not sitting here in front of every screen testing them all out. I have a 240 hertz screen though. Because, I wanted to have the lowest latency. I want to try it out and so forth.
Sure.
And, it supposedly was the best of the best when I bought it. I always look at the input lag or the latency of the TN panel. Like if it says 0.5 milliseconds versus 1 millisecond, then, that kind of interested me.
Yeah.
But that's only if you're playing like super tryhard. That's like you wanting to go pro and you just want the lowest and craziest setting, right? But there's other monitors, like there's IPS panels with 144 hertz and 240 hertz. They have a 3 millisecond lag time. And yeah, you're going to have a little bit of input lag, but the color's going to be more vibrant and so forth. So you really have to kind of like figure out what you want.
Yeah.
But if you're super tryhard, TN panel, 0.5 millisecond response time, gray to gray. And then you're good. Like my philosophy was, I never wanted the equipment to be the reason why I lost.
Yeah.
And so I always had the best equipment that I could have at that current time. And that was what kind of what launched Vitality brand in general, because the last thing I want to worry about is my equipment.
Yeah.
If I lose, I want to know I lost, not my equipment that lost, you know?
Yeah.
And so that was my philosophy of how I played. Like, so I can A/B test myself all day and like try to get better myself. But if my equipment fails me in a heated battle, like say I'm moving the mouse and it flips out or something like that, or it gets stuck or something happens, then that my equipment failed me, yeah. Right? So I need to buy something that is consistent, reliable, and so then I can be the one that, if I have a problem, it's me and not the other way around. And so basically the mice, like, you know, back when I played, we were playing with ball mice, you know.
Yeah, sure.
I used to have a screwdriver, rubbing alcohol, and Q-tips to clean out my mouse. Actually, I still have the ball mouse over here. Then I think the Microsoft IntelliMouse 2.0 came out. It was probably basically the best optical gaming mouse that came out, period. And that mouse is still great today. I mean, that mouse came out almost 20 years ago. And it still kills people really good. I still hop it in every once in a while to play with it. But, you know, there's new technology coming out now with wireless gaming mice and so forth. So,
Do you play with cable mouse or with wireless?
I actually been playing with the wireless lately just to test it out. Like, you know, I'm all about testing things out and seeing where it stands. There is some latency with going wireless.
Yeah.
It's basically unnoticeable, but there is a hair of latency. but they do have some mice, you know, the closer you have the signal to the mouse, it could be like 1 millisecond or 3 milliseconds, whatever the deal is. So, it's been pretty good. Like, I'm pretty impressed with having the no cord and be able to play with it. Typically I'm always a corded mouse guy. Like, if I was to play in a serious pro tournament, you know, I'd probably stick to the wired mouse. But I don't know. Like, I played a tournament the other day. I mean, like, again, these aren't world championships. These are like just like exhibition show matches. People invite me to these charity tournaments and so forth. And I won with the wireless mouse. it's not like going from 60 hertz to 144 hertz. Like, that's like a massive upgrade. And then also just the computer itself, like having a computer that's overclockable or having a powerful Intel or AMD processor in there and having a great graphic card. Like, those things are very important, because the more frames you see, the more opportunity you have to see what your opponent does and is going to do and be able to shoot them efficiently with low input lag. When you're buying equipment and using different equipment, you want to get the best you can get out of it. And you want to be you don't want to be the reason why you lost, you know. So that's, I've always been the kind of guy, like, I need to have the best and have the latest greatest, because I don't want someone to have a one up on me either. I want to be a level playing field. And when you go to tournaments, you're on a level playing field. Everyone's playing on the same box, the same system, everything. And that's how I did it throughout my career. I would actually buy or get the equipment that's going to be used in the tournament and duplicate it at my training facility at my house. So I would have like a 5 or 6 man LAN center in my basement, basically my friend's house.
Nice.
And that's where I lived that a long time. And I trained a lot there. I live in Las Vegas now in a condo high rise. So it's a little different now, but I still have friends come over every once in a while. I have a little table over here and gave me a laptop.
Oh, cool.
And we game it up and do a little LAN party here, but most people just play from home. But I try to do the LAN parties every once in a while, because it's so nostalgic to hang out with your friends. And it's still like the human connection is still a lot of fun.
Absolutely.
Like, I missed that part about it, because like traveling with a computer and going to LAN parties back in the day was.
Yeah,
was,
you have to.
That was the life.
The huge monitors. We still do it once a year with like almost 20 people. It's still a lot of fun.
Yeah. I mean, LAN parties are just a blast. Like, you know, and I'm trying to find ways to do more of that kind of stuff here in Las Vegas. It's just, you know, people are not trying around their computers much anymore.
Yeah, that's true. And it's funny that the monitors got LiDAR with the smaller panels, and now the screen gets always bigger, so they get heavier again. And now I have to like carry like my ultra wide, and it's I think it's almost as heavy as my God. Old one. And people always hate it because you when you bring the huge screen.
Yeah. That's awesome though. I mean, like I've been looking at this 38 inch widescreen panel for a while, and like I just can't pull the trigger on it because of that 3 millisecond stat, you know.
Yeah.
I just get so scared. Like I was like, man, I don't think I want to give up my, you know, my input lag.
Your advantage.
Yeah. So you, I'm a hardcore guy for good products.
But so you mentioned the tournaments back in the day. How were they like in comparison to modern tournaments? Like, you said you used the same equipment at your home, so they already had like several computers with the identical equipments. No one had to bring their own stuff. It was like that's the same.
Yeah, it's always been like that. I mean, like every tournament I played in, I mean, any official, like even the qualifiers. Everyone's using the exact same computer.
Okay.
You could only bring your peripherals. You could bring your keyboard, your mouse, your headphones, mouse pad, gel, you know, whatever you needed to play the game. But yeah, the computers were always the same. Like, and that was that's been going. I mean, that's been the standard forever. Like,
but,
I mean,
but what did change?
A level playing for all time.
Because you are ever one of the longest player in the game. So what did you see what changed in esports, in professional gaming in the, I don't know, last 20 years? What was the biggest change?
Well, I mean, I can tell you just from my own experience, like what it was like when I was going. I mean, you know, I remember at the very first tournament, like 1993, the Frag 3 tournament, where it was like kind of the, you know, all the best players were there. It was my first like money tournament I went to. I remember running out of tournament in my socks, you know, just it was like a massive LAN party and you're running around, you're having a great time, hang out with all your friends. You're getting to meet everyone for your first time because no one knows what each other looks like. So all we know is our nicknames. And so every time we meet each other, it's like, oh, you're Fatality. Oh, you're Devourer. Oh, you're Batch. Oh, you're Rix. Like, you're, you know, like, no one knew what people looked like. So it was fascinating. You're just like going through, oh, you're Culprit? Oh, dude, like, oh, man, like, I do, like, I play with you all the time. It's like, yeah, like, so then you start, like, hanging out with these people. And it was just, like, it was so much fun. I mean, you're just having a great time. And, you know, obviously we're all there to compete. You know, people have seen demos of each other. And one of my demos got very popular before the tournament. And so I was kind of like the dark horse coming in. Everyone kind of knew, oh, we should watch out for Fatality kind of thing. But I was kind of like the unknown. It was like my first, like, you know, kind of coming out party for my Quake career. You know, so everyone was kind of excited to see me play. And obviously I did really well in the tournament. I was smashing people. Ended up taking third, though, to some unfortunate events of, like, I spawned too fast, like, three times in a row, and I gave my opponent the lead, and I lost, like, you know, the semifinals to go to the finals, which was really, it really pissed me off, because I made, like, kind of, like, a mental mistake, but, like, also, I don't think I actually had the knowledge of, like, waiting my spawn out. I don't think I was, like, in my playbook yet, and then I learned from that mistake. And then I was basically after that, I was on a mission. And then I went on to win like every tournament I entered after that year, pretty much. I think I took second at one, but like I won like 10 or plus tournaments. I won like every tournament I entered, I was winning. And so, you know, one of the things I always kind of took from my career is like whenever I lost, first thing I would throw away like my shoes, my shirt, my pants, like whatever I was wearing for that tournament for like that was bad luck. I can't wear that anymore. but I always try to like learn from that experience. Like what did I do wrong? Where did he get me at? And so when you lose, you gotta take that information and use it to your advantage. Like you can't make that same mistake again when the heat and the pressure gets to you. So you know, it's a ton of fun. I love it. I love the training and all that stuff for it. It was a blast.
But how do you
feel? Yeah, so I guess how it evolved is what the question was.
Yeah.
Was, you know, in 2005 when I played like my last big world championship, you know, that I won. There it was like, you know, 10 stops across the world. We were competing all around Asia, Europe, America, South America. We were like, we were literally everywhere. And that was like professional gaming to what it is today, like where there's like monthly tournaments or monthly events and so forth. And so we were doing that in 2005. And that was kind of the beginning of like esports going to the next level. Obviously, we proved the point of live streaming back then, before Twitch, before all this stuff happened. But we did a live stream of my match versus Vu in the grand finals. And we had over 90 countries tuned in to watch our match. Yeah. So we were definitely way ahead of our time. But we were
kind
of the
stream?
We were basically the pioneers of like that whole live streaming and you know, showing esports how it could be.
And where did you stream back in 2005?
It was MTV Overdrive. So MTV Overdrive live streamed the whole production, the whole event, all the gameplay. We had announcers, commentary, everything.
Oh, wow.
And it was it was a pretty big deal. I mean, it was a $1 million world tour. It was the biggest tournament in esports history at that time. And I ended up winning the tournament. And it was pretty amazing. If anyone ever gets a chance, I want to watch a really fast gameplay. You can watch the 2005 World Tour Finals.
Nice. Yeah, I think it's really interesting to see how it changed. It gets bigger all the time. I think the people it gets broader, more people watch it. But I don't know if you feel the same, but I still think it seems like esport is a niche. Millions watch it, but in the broad and ESPN and whatever they show it, but it seems still small.
So like the reason why I believe that is, like, you know, people do definitely tune in, people definitely watch, people, the hardcore definitely are engaged, the fans are there, right? The hardcore fans. The problem right now is getting the mainstream connected to esports and gaming and making it easier for people to be reminded when these things are happening. The thing is, like, when a Super Bowl is about to happen in football, in American football, we are blasted on TV. There's media everywhere to remind people of when that event is, to make sure you plan for it and so forth. So one of my new companies is called Ready Up, and our goal is to help people find, follow, and join in. So if you get a chance, check out www.readyup.com. But we're a B2B platform helping people engage into finding when these events are, adding them to their native calendar so they're reminded when those events are happening, with call to actions and so forth. So our goal is to kind of make it easier for the mainstream to get into esports, but, you know, not have to be a hardcore guy going through forums, going through Reddit to find out when these events are. It's too hard to get into esports, like of knowing when the qualifiers are, where the live stream is. Like if you're not into it, yeah, you're not going to know. And so our goal is to kind of bring all that stuff to the surface with Ready Up, and basically, season 21 starts this next weekend. Make sure you plan for it. Get your friends together and do an event or just play, have fun, engage into it. The Overwatch semifinals is at 7 p.m. Make sure you add to your calendar. So then you, on your native calendar, on your phone, you'd be like, oh, okay. You pull it up and you'll be like, there it is, you know. So our goal is to kind of help that process be easier, and our goal is to help businesses engage with their audience so they become more engaged in what they're trying to push and what they're trying to have their users do. And so our goal is to help them out and help them find out about qualifiers, tournaments, events, downloadable content, when the new season starts, when's the finals, all those kind of things. We're trying to add it to their native calendar so they're engaged and they know when exactly it is.
Yeah, and I guess another big problem is that people who are not hardcore gamers, esport is sometimes difficult to watch, to understand what is happening. I think that is a big hurdle to get into.
And since, you know, in some games, like the mobile games specifically, yeah, I mean, a mainstream person is not going to have a clue. That's why I always like 1v1 deathmatch, because when you watch me play 1v1 deathmatch,
yeah,
it's very easy to know how to play the game. That guy killed him. That guy killed me. Like, you know, like it's very like linear. Like it's like a boxing match or a fight. You know, mm-hmm. One guy's beating up another guy, you know, the other guy's getting it. And, you know, but those type of games have been taken out of the circuit just because, you know, I think it's managed because of the amount of money these game developers can make doing team-based games and making games more friendly or more team-orientated for everyone. So, you know, people, you know, the game developers definitely have stepped away from making high-skill cap games. It's more about high-skill teamwork games. And if you have a team, you're going to dominate. Yeah. Like, there's just no way around it. Like, teamwork is a dream.
Yeah, that's true. There aren't many single-player esport games. I mean, Hearthstone but most of the games are team sports.
And the thing is, like, in like Hearthstone, it's like it's cards versus cards. You know, it's not like someone can play a card better than another person. You know, like, there is a skill there for sure. you know, but like, it's like this the skill cap between a guy going crazy, like hitting headshot, like, you know, or whatever the deal is, there's a lot of skill in there. There's like only so many people in the world that probably could have done that move, right? And so, you know, the hand-eye coordination that's in shooters is so extreme that a person could really outplay someone if they were given the opportunity. So it's just like, you know, but some of these games, like, there's so much so many different things to talk about. Time to kill, like how long it takes to kill a guy. You know, like in Apex Legends, for example, when the game first came out, if you were just a one-man badass, you could really wreck the server. But now the time to kill and the weapons and so forth, they've nerfed the wingman back in the day and all this other stuff. They basically made the game more about three guys killing three guys and not about one guy just wrecking a couple guys and then moving in or whatever deal is. So, you know, I could talk about this all day because it's just something that I've lived and done. And you know, when the game requires immense amount of skill, like, you know, an arena shooter, I believe, you know, a lot of these people can't hold a candle to it. You know, they hate it. But, you know, I used to hate switching games too. I mean, I know the feeling of, like, you know, being really good at a game and then sucking at another game. But, you know, I put the practice in and the time in, and then you create that high skill cap again. But I don't know. It's just, like, hard to talk about because, like, the younger generation probably doesn't understand the arena shooters. So, but, you know, hopefully there'll be some more. I hope, and I kind of, like, what I hope is that these games – get like eventually the evolution of shooters is that we'll go back to arena shooters.
That was my question. If you think they will come back.
Yeah, so that's kind of like, I think the games will eventually have to evolve because I think people will get tired of the same old fight, the same fight over and over again, like the same basic fight over and over again. Whereas I think, like, you know, you need a higher skill cap so you can differentiate the best players between the good players. When everyone's amazing, it comes down to who has the best teamwork and best synergies. Mm-hmm. And teamwork's always important. I'm just talking out loud.
So, what do you think makes a good esport game? I mean, to watch or to play? Or what makes it just for you? I mean, for you to play, what?
I like the 1v1 deathmatch games. I think there's a lot of skill in there. I'm not a big fan of, like, having each character having abilities and so forth and all that kind of stuff. I think it should be an even playing ground. When you spawn into the game, everyone's equal. You know, that was how we played. I mean, that was the deal. You spawn in and everyone's equal. There's no one has special abilities, special moves, whatever deal is. You can go get those items. You can go get the mega health. You can go get the red armor. You can go get the ammo and control those items and so forth. And then you fight out, you know, mano a mano. And so, you know, I like fast games. I like games that don't restrict me. I'm not a big fan of sniper rifles in games because I think it caters to camping and slow play. I like games where you have to press forward to fight, and pressing forward is an advantage. So I want to see action. I want to see fireworks. I want to see people fragging it out, you know. So you know.
But you
I think so, you know, for a lot of people, they should really watch like my Panker finals with Vu, like, and they can really see, like, you know, there's definitely a skill and a mindset of like being aggressive and defensive at certain times, but there's certain times you can go super aggressive. And in that game, there was no railgun. There was, so you weren't, you really couldn't camp. You could really walk into a guy and then get him, you know, or start the fight. You know, so it was a little harder to run away in that game. And I like that, you know, if someone makes a mistake, they got to pay the price. So, you know, and that mistake could be, you know, you died once, but you might die three or four or five more times because you made that one mistake. So, you know, I like that, you know, it's like, that's what I like.
So you must like the gulag in Warzone.
The Gulag and Warzone is a cool addition to Battle Royale games in general. I really think Battle Royale games are really a lot of fun. But there is a dynamic of camping in that game too.
yeah, that's true.
So it's, but I don't know. I still like it. I mean, you know, like I did it, you know, and when I got number one in North America solos for PUBG, believe me, I wasn't pressing forward into people. I was playing the odds, I was playing the numbers, I was hiding like huts, I was hiding, you know, behind a tree or whatever deal is, trying to get my angle, you know, and only come out when I had to sacrifice myself. Sacrifice myself. And so I want to limit my exposure to the world as much as possible. Because, you know, how are you going to cover all 360 degrees? It's like almost it's basically impossible. So you really got to like narrow it down to there's only one or two options. And that's almost in every game you play. Like you really want to have only one option. Like the guy has to come through here, have your crosshair set up, take the shot.
Yeah.
You know, if you're like this, like going back and forth, eventually you're going to like turn one way. And you're like, ah, he comes in. And then like, you're like already, you know, 500 milliseconds or 800 milliseconds to switch back. And he's already coming around the corner, looking around that corner when he's pressing forward. Then he takes a shot in 200 milliseconds or 300 milliseconds, you're going to lose the fight.
Yeah.
I look at a lot of the fights as mathematical situations, and that's how everyone should be looking at the situation when they fight.
Yeah, now it seems to be all about the battle royales or the hero shooter. What do you think may come next, the next big thing?
It's so funny because I predicted the Battle Royale. one of my friends was telling me, he was asking me a question about what's the next big game. And I told him by far, if I could have 100 people in the server, last man standing, that would be the coolest thing ever. And then bam, it happened.
And when was that?
And so, say again?
When was that? When did you?
It was before PUBG. You know, it was like, I don't know, 2014, 2015, I don't know. It was before everything came out. Because I always had my own ambition to create my own game. And I felt like that was the evolution of gaming and was what would be fun for people to play in. And it was funny just when it happened, you know, one of my good friends, he's a game developer, and he always brags about it. He's like, yeah, Fatality predicted Battle Royale. if I had to predict the next thing, I mean, right now we're diving back into Counter-Strike land with Valorant. It's really hard because, like, you know, we're kind of in a lull right now for, like, kind of new exciting games to come out and so forth because everyone's played Counter-Strike. So Valorant's not a far-off, like, learning curve for a lot of people. The learning curve is learning that every character has its own abilities and own, like, you know, everyone has like their own flashbang, their own smoke, their own grenade, unique to only them, right? But like their flash might not be a flash. It might be like a robot that goes out and shoots people, or it could be setting up smokes in different areas, or teleporting behind them, or whatever the deal is. I play the game. I won a tournament for the third day in a charity tournament. So, all that stuff's awesome. I'm trying to think of what the next game is going to be, but like, I, you know, for me, I was like, why is there not an arena battle royale? You know, I just miss the fast paced shooters, you know, like the fast paced arena shooters and so forth. And,
I'm sure they will come back. Everything is coming back all the time. So I'm sure there will be a wave someday in some different version, I imagine. But I think
the thing is like Doom and Quake is kind of like my origin. You know, it's like I started playing with Doom and Quake, and so for me it's like I'm always like hoping that Quake or Doom would do something cool. You know, like a Quake Royale, a Doom Royale, whatever it is. Like, you know, they have such a great engine with Doom, and I feel like they can do more with it. But I'm not a game developer, but I just, you know, I have like my own things that I would like to see in games.
Yeah.
And maybe down the road, there will be some opportunities there to be a part of like, you know, the game design more so than just like, you know, oh, what do you think?
Yeah, sure. And so what is your opinion? Where do you see esport heading? Because I was wondering how it is because I just see it from like the sidelines. I don't watch a lot of esports, but just some time. And yeah, I see it get bigger, but I think it feels that it doesn't get more important. I mean, I don't know. It's difficult to tell. So I was just wondering what you think.
Yeah, well, the biggest problem I have is like, you know, that's why I started my new company Ready Up, is just that people just don't know when these events are. People are not, they don't know how to engage or when to engage. They aren't reminded. So like, I feel like we have a big disconnect with the mainstream. The mainstream now knows esports. They know the term. They know it's possible to make a living at playing video games. And they know there's live streamers. They know there's YouTubers. They know all this stuff, okay? So we finally have educated the world, okay? So like, finally, okay? So now, you know, we got the world to this point, okay? Now how do we get them to the next point? And so that's kind of like, you know, with Ready Up, like my goal is to help them connect to these events easier. So they tune in, they watch, they participate. Maybe they want to try to qualify for one of these tournaments. So I think there's a lot of people in the world that want to be able to do this. And the thing is, it's so easy to participate because everyone can do it from their home. It's not like you're going out and trying not to be on a football team or a soccer team where you actually physically have to show up at a venue, right?
Yeah.
This stuff you can do from home, anywhere in the world. If you have internet connection, you can partake in it, right? So the potential is massive.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's what my goal is, just to help connect those people to our world. And so, you know, creating this Ready Up network where we can engage the people, have call to actions, get them informed of when their favorite tournaments are happening and so forth. So that's kind of our goal. And it's my own personal goal, is to help the mainstream get connected to esports in an easier way.
Yeah.
And that's one of my missions in life, I guess, since I'm not playing in professional tournaments anymore. But my professional tournament now is trying to help connect esports to the mainstream.
So do you think it will be in, let's say, in 10 years or when like the next generation is in their 30s or whatever, will it be as big as some other traditional sports?
I think esports has already passed a lot of traditional sports. You know, it definitely has numbers there to kind of like prove that. And, you know, it's definitely happening. I think it's just, you know, esports continues to get bigger every day. It has so pretty much over the last two decades. It's grown enormously. And, you know, I don't see it stopping. You know, I see it continue to grow. And, you know, once we get more people connected, there'll always be another way to help promote it, push it, and support it. You know, you look at traditional sports, they all have a new way to make people interested, a new way to engage people, and they go down that rabbit hole. And, you know, in esports, we have to do the same thing. But right now, our goal is just how do we connect the mainstream to esports? And that's my goal at Ready Up. And I think this is the goal almost for everyone. I mean, you know, for anyone in esports, they're always trying to get more people to come to their events, trying to get more people to engage and so forth. And I think we're offering a very viable solution for them right now. So that's just our goal. And we've been getting a lot of good feedback from the publishers and the game developers and the community sites and so forth that, you know, they see the value in what we're doing.
Yeah.
It's basically just turning the switch on right now. So this is something I've been working on for a while as a startup, and yeah, if you get a chance, go to readyup.com.
Yeah, I already checked it out. Yeah, it looks good. That's good. And I think that's another difficulty, because in esports you always have new games. There's not just one esport game. So
yep.
they are changing up, and probably every year there's another big contender. And
yeah,
I mean, it's interesting, but also difficult to
Well, the thing is, like, that's what makes it fresh and exciting too. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not the same thing over and over and over again, right? I mean, how many times can you watch someone do an ability that you know the outcome already before it happens? So it's like, for sure. Like, you know, throughout my career, I've been working at 5 different games, and so and the reason why was because one game would die off and there'd be no more prize money for that. There's a whole tournament for it, but there'd be no real prize money. So I had to switch if I want to be a professional gamer. Like, you have to make the move. And so I went to, you know, I won a car in Inverse Power 2. I went to Arnold Tournament. I was on MTV True Life, won 10 grand, and launched my Fatality company. Then I went on to play Pancro, where I went over 230 grand. Like, there's all these different things that happened throughout my career, but I had to make the move. And even when I made the move to the new game, like, I wasn't the best at the other game, because every game has its own fighting technique.
Yeah.
I would compare it to, like, if you're a UFC fighter, right? A mixed martial art guy, right? There's people that are really good at punching, really good guys at grappling, really good guys that are kickboxing or whatever the skill they have that is lethal, right?
Yeah.
Well, in every game, there's a different fighting technique. And it could be a close combat fight. It could be really far combat fight. It could be being very elusive. It could be being really fast and very accurate. Or it could be based on strategy alone. Like, strategy is king, you know? So, like, there's all these different fighting techniques that have happened throughout my career in different games. And I had to adjust and make adjustments for each game. And so when a new game comes out, it's kind of fun because everyone kind of starts over a little bit.
That's true.
But there is people that came from previous games that might have a ton of knowledge too. So it's like when Apex Legends came out, the game was very fast. It was like kind of almost like, you know, vertical jumps and jumping down on people, shooting like crazy, really twitchy game kind of like. And I was dominating people in that game because people weren't used to people moving that fast in games. And, you know, typically if you jump and shoot, you lose accuracy. Well, in this game, you don't.
Yeah.
You know? So people were standing still and just trying to shoot. And, like, you know, like, okay, bam, 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 bam. We're just doing, like, circles around them, right? So, you know, that's when the game changes and so forth. And, yeah, game changes every couple of years. There's a new big game that comes out. Counter-Strike has been one of those games that's lasted forever. Mm-hmm. League of Legends, Dota. You know, they have their fan base. They have their stadium, so they're able to keep doing those events because, you know, the people love it and they know it. But it's not always like that. Esports is more than that. A new game comes out, could be anything really. But, you know, the shooter games are usually the most fun, at least for me. But those are the games I like. You know.
All right. So I have one last question, then and I'll let you go. And you seem to have a plan what to do, but I wonder about all the other players. What do you do as an esport pro after when you retire, when you're like young and then you can't compete anymore? What do you do? What are their options?
Well, typically for a professional gamer that quits the professional gaming circuit or not, you can always go to YouTube or Twitch or Mixer or whatever social platform and try to be an entertainer or influencer on those networks to make some money that way, because you probably built up some kind of following or liking to your professionalism. So hopefully you can parlay that into that career. But also there's jobs inside of esports. You know, if you want to become a commentator, if you want to become you know, if you want to work in products or marketing, there's different avenues to take. But you have to, you know, you might have to get some schooling. You might, there's just different ways to go about it. But there's plenty of jobs in esports and gaming for you to take an initiative in those things. You know, I mean, you could be a community manager. You could be a lot of different. There's just so many different jobs.
Cool.
But, you know, if game, you know, say if some of those things don't work out, then you just have to go back to reality of, like, you know, maybe going back to school or, you know, finding your next move. You know, it just depends on how well you did in your professional career. You know, like, you look at traditional athletes in football, you know, guys play football for 2 years and are out. What do?
Yeah,
maybe they didn't make millions of dollars. Maybe they made just like a couple million, you know, and they're done. So then what do? Yeah. So all that stuff is, you know, all that stuff is important. And so, yeah.
Cool. So, yeah, Jonathan, thank you very much for your time. It took almost an hour. So thank you very much for your time.
No, I appreciate it, man. Feel free to give me a buzz anytime. And if you guys need some more quotes down the line, feel free to buzz me anytime and we'll get some quotes in for you. I appreciate you having me on the show.
Ja, das war es mit dem Interview mit dem Jonathan Wendel, dem Fatality. Ich hoffe, es hat euch Spass gemacht. Ich hoffe, es war interessant und ihr konntet etwas lernen. Ich hoffe gleich wieder mit einer normalen Folge, nicht nur mit mir. Wenn, weiß ich noch nicht, aber ich habe jetzt schon definitiv genug zu erzählen mit all diesen Games. Ich muss wirklich irgendwann mal Platz finden für die. In der Zwischenzeit, wenn ihr etwas Input habt, wenn ihr uns Fragen stellen wollt, dann schickt sie podcast@onemorelevel.ch oder auf der Webseite. Ihr wisst, wo ihr uns findet. Ciao miteinander.